For you, bro.
And he has some fantastic books he wants to share with you. Classic, Can We Be Good Without God?
Thank you very much, Robin. Listen, I have the highest regard for your pastor, Robin, and for his family. And I do remember that little meeting in the coffee shop. It was so funny. I was sitting right there, and it's a coffee shop I almost never go to. But it was a beautiful day like today, sitting outside, and Robin came walking by. And I thought, I think I know Robin. I'm not sure. He thought he knew me. He wasn't sure. He got talking, and he said, that is exactly what I've been praying about. And it was a program we had just started, Institute for Christian Apologetics. And it was a really wonderful thing, that conversation. And Robin and I have been working together all these years, off and on, as he's done his program there, just defended his thesis a year ago. Remember that day well. Did a great job, Robin. And all the people around the table had that same evaluation of it. And it's been good. And wonderful to be with you folks in the church here today, too. I'm from Abbotsford, B.C. It's where we live. I teach at Trinity Western. I've been there since 1990. I have two sons. One is 27. He's at Carleton University studying political science. He's married, has one little girl of his own right now. And I have one other son whose name is James, and he's in the back. He's somewhere in this room right now, I believe. And he's at the back of the church. You've been with me for the whole weekend. I have just one wife, and her name is Gail. And she's back in Abbotsford. She runs a little electrolysis studio business. Been doing that for 22 or 23 years. In town, it's been a wonderful thing for her, and for all of us, for her to be doing that over these years. But Robin's right. About 1996 or 7 or so, I was having lunch with Dr. Neil Snyder, the president of Trinity Western University, and just the two of us, which we used to do occasionally just for the fun. And he said, you know, Paul, we need to start an Institute for Christian Apologetics, and you need to direct that. And I was a little bit unnerved by the thought of it, and I had seen people start new programs. I knew that meant they had to develop vision statements, purpose statements, the courses to go with this, and work out funding and how this is all going to work. And I just didn't know what to do with it. I didn't do really anything with it for a little while. And then I began to work with Ravi Zacharias at one point, and I would have young people, just like John exactly, and Rob and others come to me and say, where can we study apologetics? And I used to say, boy, I'm not sure where you'd go to really study apologetics in Canada here. And I asked Ravi, and he said, you know, there really isn't much in Canada. And I thought back to my conversation with Neil Snyder, and I went back to him and said, are you still open to that idea? He said, yeah, we are. So 2001, we opened up this brand new thing, which has been a real exciting endeavor here in Canada, called the Institute for Christian Apologetics. And some of you may be interested in pursuing, because we have a very convenient formats, ways for people to go further than a conference like this. People can come in, and you can get three different degree programs in which you specialize in Christian apologetics. That's exactly how it works out. And Robin did one of those. Robin did pretty well the most rigorous one, the Master of Theological Studies degree, which includes a thesis. And that's what Robin did. But there's other ways of doing it that don't include a thesis as well. And sometimes people come in and do one-week courses. We have the residency from Monday to Friday. You do reading ahead of time, assignments later, and you can do a course that way. We have many students around Western Canada coming in and taking courses that way, sometimes doing their entire programs that way. So if you're interested in seeing what you could do, we even have some online opportunities as well. Just go to the back, put your name on a card there, and we'll be in touch, and we can let you know more of ways you can go deeper and go further. But it's been a great thing to be working in the area of Christian apologetics. It is an odd-sounding term. We talked about this at the beginning of the conference. It sounds like we're involved in developing our skills at being professional Christian apologizers. I'm very sorry, very, very sorry. I'm a Christian. I simply won't let that happen again, or something like that. And we're going to learn how to say that again and again. Well, that's really not what the term means at all. The word apologetic comes from a classical Greek word, which is pronounced apologia, which is an old word. It was back in the time of Jesus, back in the time of Plato. One of the Socratic dialogues is actually called the Apology, in which Socrates gives a defense of himself before 500 of his peers. And the word means to give a defense. And from the very beginning of the church, from the very earliest days, different people have risen up and attacked the church, attacked Christians' teachings, lifestyle, practices, and different ones from within the Christian community have always stepped forward and given responses and defended Christian truth claims, and have always been called Christian apologists. And that's what we're all about here today. And I just like to define this word, the Christian apologetics, as really nothing more than developing our skills in communicating the gospel of Jesus, the heart of God, the love of God, in a way that is accurate, and that is appealing, and that is credible. That's what it comes down to, in a way that gives a proper defense of the faith. And of course, there are many ways of doing this, and it can be very exciting, can be a lot of fun. And God has given me different opportunities over the years. I just want to make a quick comment on some books we have for sale at the back, because I always encourage people, if you come to a conference like this, is there anything you can do to go beyond? And God has given me an opportunity to do something I had a dream of years ago, and that is write a number of books in the area of apologetics and Christian thought. And I always wondered if I'd ever get that opportunity. When I came to Trinity Western, they said, well, we don't usually use the words publish or perish, but that's pretty much how it is around here. And I thought, well, okay, so that gives me my opportunity right there. Well, I had just gotten to the university, and I was invited to debate a UBC philosopher on the question of, they titled the debate, Can We Be Good Without God? The same title as is on this book. And it was a book about moral foundations. And really, the debate was about two issues. Is there such a thing as real, objective moral truth at all? Or is morality purely relative? That was the first item. And interestingly enough, both the atheist and I agreed right up front that there is objective moral truth. He agreed right off the bat, it is way too simplistic to call morality all relative. Then the second question is, if that's the case, is God required as a foundation? And that's what that debate was all about. He was an atheist, I was a theist, of course, and we had that debate. When I got all done, I thought, you know what? That is a good issue to write further on, because there are more than just two views. There's a theistic view, an atheistic view, but there's different ways of looking at this as well. There's what's sometimes called an evolutionary morality, and that's a view. And we have this book is a dialogue between five different perspectives. One is a moral relative perspective, one is a human nature perspective, and it goes on. And that's what this book is about, those two fundamental questions. Is there such a thing as real, objective moral truth? And if so, is God required as a foundation? And that was my first crack at writing. It opened the door to a whole new world for me of opportunities, and it's been a wonderful thing. It wasn't too long after that I got a phone call one day out of the blue. You ever have those phone calls where you aren't expecting anything like this? Someone has said, would you like to debate? We're looking for someone to debate, Sven Robinson. How many of you know who that is? A member of parliament. I'd never met Sven. Actually, to tell you the truth, he and I actually have a little bit of a friendship now ever since those two debates we had. And said he was crusading around the country at the time, advocating for physician-assisted suicide. We want to host a debate with Sven on that. We're looking for someone to debate him. So I thought about it. A young man joined me. We spent about 3 months doing a lot of research together. We had one debate. Then later on, I was able to be involved in six more debates on the topic with a lady whose name is Dr. Faye Gersh, the head of the Hemlock Society out of Denver, Colorado. We went right across the whole country, different universities, and then one more with Sven later on. And I learned a lot about this issue. Interesting thing for me is at the same time this was going on, my mother had multiple sclerosis, had it for 34 years. She eventually died of it exactly 10 years ago now, right now, and on Good Friday of 2003. And I watched her go through the same processes that Sue Rodriguez was going through, although far more advanced than Sue Rodriguez ever got. And I began to realize these are the kinds of people who are sometimes asking for physician-assisted suicide. And there's much more to be said than the media often says, much more to be said than Sven Robinson was saying. And so that's what this book came as a result of. Final Wishes, it's called Cautionary Tale on Death, Dignity, and Physician-Assisted Suicide. It was quite a chore, right? Quite an opportunity to write that book. Then along comes this one, Talking About Good and Bad Without Getting Ugly. Can you come up with titles like that? I cannot. The title I sent with this book was Navigating the Moral Maze, which I still think is a perfectly good title. But I did learn something there, that the difference between a publisher and a terrorist, you know what the difference is? You can actually negotiate with a terrorist, okay? That's what I learned when I had this book underway. Now, because here's how the negotiation went. But Paul, we your title's okay. We think this other title is far better. What do you think? Yeah, thanks, Paul. We think we're going to go with that other title. And that's kind of how the negotiation went. This one's all about how to engage others on matters of ethics and morality and religious faith. How do we engage? It's so incredibly important for us, I think, to know how to engage. In our culture, we have lots of things that put roadblocks in the way. We have things that we have definitions of tolerance that are very confused. We have an unwritten rule that says you should not impose your moral values on other people. What does that even mean? Can any society run without having something imposed by somebody? What does that mean? And so we have chapters on all those in this book, and that's what this book is all about, talking about good and bad without getting ugly. Quite the title. And then this one here, Why People Don't Believe, this is the most recent one. This one, I believe, is addressing what may well be the current strongest challenge to Christianity that we've had in a long time, coming from the new atheists, The challenge is simply that religion, including Christianity, is not simply flawed and mistaken, as atheists have always said, but religion is actually, what is it? It's dangerous. It's a force for evil in the world. It's that thing that causes people to do things like fly planes into buildings and suicide bombings and blow up buses and even blow up abortion clinics and things like that. It's religion that does all that. And of course, if religious people ever get their hands on chemical weapons and biological weapons and nuclear weapons, well, they'll use those too, and we're going to be in a heap of trouble. So what's the answer? Eradicate religion from the world for the very survival of the human race. That's the challenge, and it's been coming from people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, who died some time back a few months ago. Sam Harris is another one, Dr. Daniel Dennett, an American philosopher. They made this case repeatedly in best-selling books, enough so that it's really influenced the way people think of religion, including Christianity. And that's what this book is addressing. I went to our dean about 3 years ago, and I showed him a number of articles. I said, don't you think we need to be addressing this? And he said, yeah, we do. So I took a sabbatical and did a lot of research on this issue, spent time interacting with others on it, and that's what this book is all about. It's a response to that issue, which I think we need to be doing. And so these books are at the back, publisher's discount prices. If they're useful to you, that's what you can look at. And there's other material, and I would really encourage you to stop by the Apologetics Canada table, which John has already mentioned, because there's other material useful for you. If you can take one thing away from you today, it'll be a way to add to what you learn here at the conference. You see, as we said here already, one reason it's not just fun, but important, because it can be fun, but important to continue to sharpen our abilities to communicate the heart of God and the love of Jesus in the world, is because, as we probably all know very well, by almost any measure, we're living in very interesting and very changing times, and you can see this in many different ways. And many things are in transition at the moment. Back in the 70s, we began to hear about something called postmodernism. How many have heard that term, postmodernism? Almost everybody's heard that term. And although the word was first used in the 30s, by the 80s or 90s, it had become quite a common word, representing some very deep, important cultural changes going on in the world. And as a result of that, very much of what we might call a cultural shift, we in our culture today view some things differently than we did before. Big things, things like truth, things like values, things like other cultural perspectives, religion, even clothing styles, architecture, literature, and our interpretation of literature. We do things differently than we did a few years back. Some of these challenges are actually somewhat valuable. Postmodernism, as some of you will know, has reminded us that we all see the world through a set of glasses given to us by our community. In other words, we all have a perspective on the world. All of us do. You do, and so do I. That's not a bad thing. That's not a good thing, necessarily. That's just reality. But if we don't pay attention to that, we can speak out of turn and say things that we never should say. But you see, like any intellectual change that comes to a culture, any change in the dominant thought patterns or the way we think, this cultural shift has also introduced a number of challenges and hurdles to anybody wanting to communicate the story of Jesus to the people of our culture. And that's why we have conferences like this in this weekend. This morning, I'd just like to turn our attention very briefly just to two of those. And that's what I'll do for the time I have. Two challenges that sometimes stand in the way of us presenting the gospel of Jesus to others. Let me just move into those. In fact, let me just back that up for 1 second here. I dare say that if I was to ask us today around this room, how many of us want to share the gospel of Jesus with others? I bet I'd get hands up everywhere. I mean, we want to do that, don't we? I want to do it. And most of us want to do it as well. If I was to ask you this question, how many of us believe it's the greatest message in the world? Again, we're going to get many hands. But you know what? If I was also asked, how many of us sometimes find it challenging to present this gospel of Jesus to others? How about that? Any hands go up on that? My hand would be up on that. And it's true, isn't it? It's not always easy, this business of sharing Jesus with other people. I mean, we all probably have our own story to tell about some challenge, some difficulty we've run into along the way. And sometimes those challenges are serious enough that they can keep us from sharing. They can even make us say things like, boy, I'm not going to let that happen again. That was a bad experience. I'm not going to go there again. Well, I would just say to us today that if this message really is as great and powerful and needed by our neighbors as we say it is, then we should one by one begin to address challenges so they don't stand in the way of us joyfully and confidently setting Christ before the world. Let me look at the two that I want to comment on here today for us. And, of course, there's others you could comment on, but the two I want to comment on is this. The first one is that the Christian message Christian story requires people to accept things which we are not normally called upon to accept. Is that not correct? It requires us to believe things we're not normally called upon to believe. How about that? Have you thought about that? Even the Apostle Paul, 1 Corinthians, he talked about the Christian gospel using words like scandal. He said it'll be a scandal to some people. It'll be considered foolishness to some people. It'll be a stumbling block to people. These are biblical words. Now, it's not that hard to see. I mean, just imagine this. Imagine a friend of yours gave you a phone call one day and said, I'd like to take you out for coffee. I'd like to go to Starbucks with you because there's a friend I've met recently, and I want to tell you about my new friend. Very special friend. Could we go to Starbucks so I can tell you about my new friend? You say, yeah, sure, I like Starbucks. I like hearing stories like that. Let's go. So you meet down at Starbucks, and your friend starts in. He says, yes, I met this person a few months ago. Very special person. Person's been a great help to me ever since these few months, over these few months I've known. I talk with this person every day. You say, boy, that sounds like a pretty good friend. And then your friend says this to you, you know, one of the greatest things about my new friend, he can forgive all the things I've ever done wrong. And you say, you mean he's a very forgiving person? That's great. And your friend says, no, I don't mean that. I mean, he can forgive even the things, not just the things that I do wrong to him. He can forgive all the things I've done wrong. The things I've done wrong to you, he says he can forgive those too. And what is your response going to be? You're probably going to say, well, who does your friend think he is, God? At which point your friend's going to say, well, yeah, actually, I was getting to that. Yeah, he does claim to be a divine. Okay, and what's your response going to be to that? Boy, I guess your friend doesn't have really issues with self-esteem, does he? You may say, well, can I meet your friend? Well, actually, my friend, he died. Okay, so God died. But that's okay, because he rose again from the dead. So he was God, he claimed to be divine, he can forgive sins, he died, he rose again. Can I meet him now? Well, no, because he actually lifted off, and he ascended into heaven. He sits at the right hand of God. The right hand of God? I thought you said he was God. Well, yeah, that's another part. Maybe that's for a next coffee when we meet together. Like, what are you going to be thinking about this new friend your friend is telling you about? You might even think he's a little bit delusional. Get the people with the white lab coats. I would just say, read 1 Corinthians 15. We won't do it now because we only have a limited time this morning. I do want to look at a different passage of Scripture a little bit later on. And I do realize that my Bible isn't even here. My Bible's at the back of the church somewhere. If anybody has a Bible, can turn to 2 Corinthians 4. You can have that ready for me, Robin. Thanks, bro. I'll leave that in a moment. But I would just say to this, if you turn to 1 Corinthians 15, and you don't need to turn there even now, but read that sometime, I will tell you, you will see the same story that I just relayed to you right now, that your friend told you in Starbucks there, about the kind of gospel we have to proclaim, that the Jesus and his followers ought to proclaim. That's our story. And I would just say, we should not be too surprised when people ask a reason for thinking this is true. We shouldn't be too surprised that 1 Peter even says, always be prepared to give a reason for this. Some people may shake their heads and say, this is quite a story. I've got to believe this. You're telling me I need to believe this? And 1 Peter says, you better have a reason when they ask you. Always be prepared to give a reason. I'm not even too surprised that Jesus spent 40 days with his disciples after he rose, before he ascended, doing what? Acts chapter 1, verse 3, giving them many convincing proofs that he was alive. They had just seen him publicly crucified, and now they're seeing him alive. He gave them many convincing proofs. I don't think we should even be too surprised when some people shake their heads and say, you know, I just can't believe that. That is really a tough thing. Even Paul said this is going to be a hard message for some. Furthermore, even Jesus himself had crowds of people walk away from him and say, I just can't believe this guy. That's why that happened even to Jesus. In a sense, I'd say the surprising thing is when people do accept and embrace it. And if you have your Bible, turn with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 4, because here's a passage I think that we as evangelicals don't look at nearly as much as we could. Thanks, Robin. Appreciate that. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. I just want to hone in on verses 3 through 6 on this passage. Look how the Apostle Paul talks about what we're up against when we communicate the gospel of Jesus to people outside the Christian community. And this passage has more than we're going to look at here, but in verse 3, look what he says. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 3, he says, even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. Think about that. You are now communicating a message of Jesus to somebody, and yet that message has been hidden from them. It is veiled to people who are outside the Christian community. How did that happen? Why is that so? Look at verse 4. He tells us, the God of this age, you know who that is, don't you? Satan himself, in case we're wondering. The God of this age has done what? has blinded the minds of unbelievers so they cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Did you catch the impact of that, the import of that? Here we are communicating a wonderful message to people, a message which is hidden from them because the God of this age has blinded their minds. That, for me, that raises two questions. What's the use is number one. Why bother communicating the gospel with anybody? The truth is hidden from them. The God of this world has blinded their minds, so they can't understand it. Why bother? And the second question it raises for me is, if that's the case, how can anybody ever be saved? How can anybody ever come into the kingdom of God? How can it happen? How did you come in? How did I come in the kingdom of God? Well, look at verse 6. Paul actually says how it works for him, and I think he's telling us how it works for all of us. He says, for God, who said, let light shine out of darkness, made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. You know what this passage is telling us? I think it's a very, very rich passage. It is telling us that when people come to Jesus, and I mean intelligent, rational people, people who think things through, when they come to Jesus, it is a result of the work of a work of God in their minds and hearts, who's drawing them to himself as he's doing around the world every day, lifting that veil from their eyes and minds so they can see things they never saw before. That's what the passage is telling us. And the amazing privilege we have, you have, and I have, is to simply jump on board and be a part of what the King of Kings and Lord of Lords is doing in his world. You see, he's the one who said, I'll build my church. He said, I will draw all men to myself. And we have an opportunity to be a part of what he's doing in his world. Well, that's the first thing that stands in the way sometimes of us. It's a challenge for us. Simply the message we have to communicate requires people to accept things they're not normally called upon to accept. Let me go to a second one here. We'll be fairly brief on this, but this is a critical one for us in the 21st century, and that is this. The Christian message, Christian story, requires us to believe in a gospel which is true in an age where truth is not always welcome. Have we thought about this before? Truth not always being welcome? What does that mean? I think this has special force for us today in the 21st century, the Western world, and maybe we're wondering, what does it mean to say truth is not always welcome? Well, a few years ago, an American philosopher by the name of Alan Bloom wrote a book called Closing of the American Mind. I mentioned this book a couple days ago. It's a little older book now, but I think it was hugely insightful, very insightful, and helping us to understand Western culture. It could have been called The Closing of the North American or The Closing of the Western Mind. Because for huge numbers of people, Alan Bloom pointed out, people across North America, the idea of real, objective truth, the old-fashioned kind, which is the truth you have when you say one thing is true and its opposite is false, okay? Not a subjective idea where two things which conflict can both be true. Real, objective truth, according to Alan Bloom, in the minds of many people, is not simply problematic, not simply hard to achieve. It's actually, Bloom said, in the minds of many people, a dangerous idea. Dangerous? Why is objective truth dangerous? What makes it dangerous? Bloom said, you know what? Because as far as many people are concerned, many of our friends and neighbors, real objective truth leads people to say things like, I'm right, because I have some truth on my side here. Which means if you disagree with me, guess what? You're wrong. In other words, the fear many people have is that if you think real truth is out there and you have some of it, then if you disagree with someone, it's not just disagreement. As far as you're concerned, you're right and they're wrong. And that leads to all sorts of terrible things in the world, things like wars and riots and intolerance and bigotry and racism and violence and imperialism and many things, many of the world's largest problems. They come from the existence of a real objective truth. So there becomes this widespread suspicion and fear of truth and people who speak as if they have the truth. And the question is, where has this led us? Well, it's led us. I think, and Bloom pointed this out, but even without Bloom, we'd know this. It's led us to, in one sense, abandon truth, or at least to define it totally different, and in fact, to define it in terms of perspective. So we no longer speak of our views and convictions and things we believe as being true anymore, unless we really redefine that term, but rather simply as our perspective. It's the way I see the world. You see it this way, I see it this way, and if we want to use the word truth at all, we'll often speak of it in terms of my truth. Have you heard that term? This is my truth. You have your truth, I have my truth, which is just another way of saying this is my perspective on the world and it's your perspective. Rabbi Zacharias actually put his finger on it pretty well when he said, in our society today, it is permissible to believe anything you want to, so long as you don't call it true. In other words, you can have your truth, i.e. perspective, and I have mine. And the fact that our truths differ and conflict does not matter because of how we're viewing truth. Truth has become perspective. Maybe you've seen this in your interactions with friends or colleagues or the media or in politics or whatever. Well, the point is that this way of thinking about truth represents a paradigm shift, a fundamental, foundational shift in the thinking of our culture. And here's why it's so important for us as Christians today. Because it will affect the way people respond to the message of Jesus. Because you see, as we said a few minutes ago, when we proclaim the message of Jesus to the world, is it not true? We're not proclaiming it simply as your perspective or my perspective on the world. We're proclaiming it as a message which is true. Is that not correct? In other words, the message we have to the world is this. There really is a supernatural creator and sustainer of the universe. He really is there. That's our message. Not only that, he really did reveal himself to us in the person of Jesus. That is a true statement. Number three, Jesus really did die for the sins of the world. He rose again. This really happened. This is a historical fact. And number four, forgiveness of sins and eternal life really are available. These are free gifts by simply putting faith in Jesus. These statements Christians proclaim to the world as true statements, not simply as our perspective on things. And see, we ought never to shy away from proclaiming them, but I would say this, we should also not be too surprised if some who hear this message stumble over the simple fact that we put them forward as true. Now that leads us to this question. Is there anything we can do about this in conversation with others? Or are we simply left with a standoff? I say this message is true. You don't like the idea of truth. That's where it all ends. We have this standoff, this conceptual brick wall. There's no way forward. I don't really think it's that bad. I don't think we're left with a standoff with nothing to say. Because I've noticed something about truth that maybe you've noticed as well. And that is this. The real objective truth is notoriously difficult to eliminate. Have you noticed that? It is very, very difficult to get rid of. And I mean even for those who want to be rid of it, even those who would like to get rid of it. And I would say this, and we can point this out as graciously as we can, I think that no one really does actually succeed in getting rid of it. For instance, look at the statement here. Here's an interesting statement. Think about this. Look at the statement. Truth is all a matter of perspective. How about that statement? That's an interesting statement, isn't it? Because tell me this, is that not a statement which claims to be objectively really true? And yet at the same time, it tells us the truth is all a matter of perspective. In other words, it claims to tell us what truth is really like. And yet it's saying truth is all a matter of perspective. So guess what? It's an internally incoherent statement. That's what you end up with when you try to say it. Truth is all a matter of perspective. It's a little bit like this statement, just another little example here. What about the person who says, you know, nothing can be known with certainty? The question you have right off the bat is, oh yeah, is that true? Is that so? Is that the case? Because that statement, again, claims to tell us something which is really true, in fact, certain. And that's the difficulty with trying to eliminate truth. It's notoriously difficult to get rid of, which means I think the real question is not, is there truth out there? The real question is, where is the truth? How do I find it? I think we all have an opportunity to point people to the four Gospels, historical documents which tell us about the person of Jesus. And this is, I think, one of the most exciting things we can do. Simply point people to, and all of us in this room can do that, point people to the four Gospels, historical documents which tell us about the person of Jesus, which look very much like they were written by eyewitnesses, and the historical record back to the first century tells us they were written by eyewitnesses, people who were there. And then we read about a person who claimed to be the way, the truth, and the life. And they can see what they think about Jesus for themselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Chamberlain. And again, I have the privilege here to introduce somebody I just actually met back in March 1 and 2, Dr. John Patrick, coming from Ottawa, Augustine College president. And I met him for the first time there, and it was a scary encounter for me as I listened to him speak at the conference there. To borrow the analogy from D.A. Carson there, I felt like this moth being drawn into the light, and the closer I got, the more I was getting burned, but the message was so good, I couldn't help myself. But I'd like to ask him if he would come up here and continue to speak to us, if you'd welcome him. Thank you.